Okay, great. Well, I guess let's start here, maybe. Bob?
Bob Parker, Echo Northwest.
Seth Goodman, Echo Northwest.
David Reeser, City of Springfield.
Guy Weiss from the Emerald Arts Center.
Lee Byer, Center of Planning Commission.
Don Lentz, President.
Johnny Kirschman, Planning Commission.
Doug McKay, Retail Warner.
George Greer, Lane County Farm Bureau.
Dave Mark, is your real estate?
Dan Egan, Springfield Chamber, and I told Dave at 7:30 I need to get up and leave for another meeting. It's my daughter.
That's a good.
You get your girl.
Those were okay. We had some minutes that were mailed out. Did anybody have any corrections to them, or shall we let them stand as mailed? Seeing no corrections, they stand as mailed. Public testimony? Any public?
Well, I'm very much in the public, but
well, why don't you join us at the table?
There's a couple of empty chairs here, Richard.
Have a seat. Good to see you, Richard.
Does anybody not know Richard? Give me the name.
Richard Boyles. I'm serving today as Kerry Weston's delegate. I'm a member of the board of directors of Sevelco and the developer and the delegate.
Is there any that you don't own in Springfield?
Yeah, what are you think?
All right. How does that mean?
Lee?
Yes.
I was just going to mention, in regards to public testimony, I left some papers around at each person's chair that you'll see in the stack. There is one article that was given to us by one of our stakeholder committee members, Mr. Greer, and that was given to us last meeting, so I'm providing that to each of you right now. Similar to the last meeting, another member, Stephen Yeh, had provided articles to each of you. So. So that's what that is.
All right. No other public here, so we will then proceed to legal review. Over there. Right here. Just one.
You're supposed to go.
Come in, just roll.
Roll. Okay, my name is Bill Van Vactor. One of the attorneys at Leahy Van Vactor Cox, and I have been charged tonight in 10 minutes or so to touch base with you with regard to the Oregon statutes regarding ethics. And the first thing I guess I'll say is we'll touch on it in a few minutes. It's the 2007 amendments to the ethics legislation have been somewhat controversial and may be subject to some change in 2009. But the reality is, in the meantime, we all have to comply with those and live with those statutes. And they are not a model of clarity, so we can't answer every question that arises with any certainty, but we do our best to get our way through it. Any inquiry in terms of the Oregon, I call it the Code of Ethics, used to be called a code, now it's just the ethics law apply to me, always begins with what are you serving on and whether or not that's a public body. And the definition in Oregon of a public body is very broad. It's any kind of entity that makes a recommendation to a decision maker in the governmental process. So in the sense that you will be making recommendations to the Planning Commission, which will go forward to the City Council, you are making recommendations to governing bodies, and therefore you are a public body. Now the next question is, if it's a public body, are you, as a member of it, a public official? And that, there again, the definition is extremely broad. It means any person, appointed, agent, or otherwise, is serving the state of Oregon or any of its political subdivisions. We're obviously serving the city of Springfield, which is a corporation of Oregon. And so I guess I don't know whether to say congratulations or condolences, but you're all public officials for this purpose. To get right to the heart of the matter, because we don't have a lot of time, there's kind of two major areas that we need to have significant concern about. And the first is whether or not in your role here and what you're going to be doing, you're going to confront any conflicts of interest. And did they all have the memo?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. If you look at page 2, we gave you the definition of both the conflict of interest and the potential conflict of interest. And the key word on conflict of interest is taking any action which would be to the private pecuniary benefit, to your personal benefit, and or the avoidance of a detriment. So it doesn't necessarily have to be positive. It can be avoiding a debt, for example. That can also be a conflict of interest. And then potential conflict of interest could be, at this point in time, you don't know whether it might be a conflict of interest. It just could be. So those are two critical words. One is would, if it will, be to your pecuniary benefit. There's a conflict of interest, and that triggers just the second one path. If it's a potential, if it could be to your private pecuniary benefit, then it triggers another path. Going on with the memo, fortunately, with that very broad definition of potential conflict of interest, you could go, geez, anything I could do in the world could ultimately somehow indirectly end up being my pecuniary benefit. That's incredibly broad. So the legislature adopted what are called class exceptions. And so if ultimately you make recommendations to the Planning Commission and City Council which affect commonly situated citizens, and you're one of those commonly situated citizens, it doesn't apply. For example, if you're a realtor on this and you make some recommendation that affects all realtors, be safe in Springfield, then that's not a potential conflict of interest.
How about a property owner?
Property owner, it's a little dicier. If you own, example I gave in the memo is if you own, say, some rural residential property, and lots of people own rural residential property in Springfield, and this group recommends something that affects all rural residential property the same, then I think the class exception applies. I don't think it's a potential conflict of interest. On the other hand, as I say later in the memo, if you own a unique piece of rural property, say something like a 100-acre commercial piece of property, and this group recommends something that only affects 100-acre parcels, and you have the only one, then at that point in time, when it focuses to you and there aren't other people equally impacted, then the class exception doesn't apply. So you have to kind of go through that sort of analysis. In terms of the next part of the memo is, what should you do if you think you have a conflict of interest? And again, the statute's pretty clear. When you have a potential conflict of interest, you need to announce that publicly, the nature of it, prior to taking any action thereon. And it's real important for, I guess, the folks to understand that you need to declare that, and then you need to kind of make eye contact with who's ever taken the minutes. Is that you,
yes.
Dave? To make sure that that is noted, because there have been unfortunate situations in Oregon where the elected official goes, well, everybody knew I had a conflict, so I just mentioned, well, you know, I own such and such. Didn't say the magic words, didn't get the minutes, and the Ethics Commission found a violation. So I looked at David to make sure that is noted. And obviously, if you have an actual conflict of interest, if the action would affect your private pecuniary situation, then you have to withdraw at that point in time. In a lot of circumstances, that actually means getting up to the table and sitting in the audience to let a particular agenda item that would impact you is finished with this large group. That's probably not too necessary. It's much more necessary when you're like the mayor, or it's a very small group, and your physical presence can kind of affect how the discussion proceeds. I want to spend a minute on the public policy choice that Oregon made. And I refer to the legislature a lot in the memo, but having lived in Oregon through this, I suspect Lee remembers this and some others. Actually, the Oregon's ethics and code of ethics was actually enacted by an initiative by the citizens after Watergate. It's a difficult piece of law to construe because the citizens passed some, and then the legislature has tweaked it probably just about every session since the 1970s. But nevertheless, the policy discussion went on when it was debated and the citizens voted on it. It's been continued with the current legislature, is that Oregon really faced two choices. It could have gone, we want pure decision makers that have no even potential conflicts of interest. The problem with that is, if you do that, you end up with either appointed people or you end up people with citizens who don't have any knowledge of the of the quote real world. And Oregon debated that and said, no, we would rather have people who work in area, who know the subject matter, who participated in it every day, who know the real world, and have them simply declare, so it's out in the public sunshine, sort of an approach to conflicts of interest, especially potential conflicts of interest. And so I guess the policy point I want to make here is, it's fine, it's understandable in Oregon to have a potential conflict of interest. Don't feel bad about it. It happens all the time. Make sure you declare it and you're just complying with the statutory scheme that Oregon has. Because we're kind of a sunshine state, we want to know about it. But we also need citizens that are knowledgeable and know the real world to help guide governance. Otherwise, we could end up with a lot of regulations that don't make any sense when actually applied in the real world. So Oregon made that policy choice. So, as I say in there, if you think you face a potential conflict of interest, declare it, but by all means continue to participate in the process, because Springfield, the state of Oregon, we need your expertise. The other point that we need to touch on is gifts. The 2007 legislature radically redefined gifts for us all. They put the limit at $50. This is my personal view. It wrote a law that kind of works for legislators, doesn't necessarily work for the rest of state government, doesn't necessarily work for local government. Pretty difficult to administer that. And it applies to gift giving. What's prohibited is a gift from anyone that has a legislative or administrative interest in wherever you are a public official. And legislative or administrative interest means an economic interest distinct from the general public in one or more bills, resolutions, regulations, proposals, or other matters subject to the action or vote of a person acting in capacity as a public official. Again, very broad definition, legislative or administrative interest, but it creates bizarre circumstances where two local governments that do work together, say Springfield Utility Board and the city of Springfield, with that broad definition, they actually have an administrative and legislative interest between each other. So this year, when Springfield Utility Board sponsored the Light of Liberty, activities in Highland Park over the 4th of July, the city of Springfield representatives got invited, had to have the city of Springfield pay for that so that there wasn't any violation of the gift statute. So again, as I said, maybe it works for legislators. It's got some real problems, I think, at the local level. Lee, if I had more time, he could probably tell us some at the state level as well. But nevertheless, we have to live with that. The legislature, kind of recognizing somewhat how complex this is, did adopt a whole series of what I'd call narrow exceptions, but you have to kind of meet every kind of circumstance in the statute in order to qualify. If you have 10 minutes on this subject, we have simply attached at the back of the memo part of the definition of gift in ORS 020 5A, which is gift, and then you'll notice that the gift definition there at the top of the page is very small, but what gift does not mean goes on for page and a half. And so we don't have time tonight to drill down on each one of those, but there are circumstances. I was talking to Lee before the meeting. The practical advice we're giving City of Springfield elected officials, Springfield Utility Board elected officials, is on these minor things, these lunches, these celebrations, these events, just have your organization pay so that there's not any sort of question. For you, thinking about the potential with regard to the urban growth boundary, I guess my practical caution would be very careful around any of the citizens who may happen to own land on the edge of the urban growth boundary, just on the outside of the growth boundary that may want to take you to dinner or may want to take you and so forth. Certainly appropriate for you to visit sites, look at them, all that sort of thing, but just avoid anything of pecuniary benefit so that you don't get any allegations later that members of the commercial investment buildable land stakeholders group is biased because of improper gifts and so forth. Last thing I want to touch on, because I think two of the members here are planning commissioners, is there's a separate statute with regard to planning commissioners that again creates another class exception for them. It's my understanding that the planning commission, Joe covered, I think last week, that under City of Springfield citizen involvement policies, when planning commissioners or elected members from the city council are appointed to these sort of groups, they're non-voting, they're ex officio, so they won't actually be in a position to have a conflict of interest anyway. Final comment I want to touch on is what the work you're doing is incredibly broad. It's very high level. It's broad public policies. Things like the vision. What vision do you want for Springfield? Where in the sense do you want it to grow? What industries do you want it to promote? It's very hard to roll all of that back and say, is the decision I make today on a density criterion going to have any sort of, is it going to affect me personally? Probably 99% of the time, it's not. But you do need to kind of go through that analysis. And if you do think it might, the practical advice we give you because of your land ownership or whatever is declare that, and then you've covered your base and you don't have anything to worry. If you kind of go through it and you still aren't comfortable as to whether or not you need to declare a conflict or whether potential or whether you in fact have an actual conflict, please give us a call, 746-9621. We've done this a lot for the elected officials of both sub and Springfield City Council. We're glad to do that for you. There's one caveat we have to provide, unfortunately, and that is that the opinion of the city attorney is not binding on the Oregon Government Ethics Commission. So even though we might say you don't have a problem, they could theoretically overrule us, and not theoretically, they have the right to overrule us and still say there's a violation. They do have a process where if you give them the facts in 60 days, they have to issue a ruling so that they can tell you whether or not you do have a conflict of interest. You know, that would, in my mind, only arise if something really major arose that affected quite a few of you, and you had the time to deal with it. That might be the way to deal with it, to get a formal opinion so you know what sort of ground you're on. But that's pretty much it. In terms of a nutshell, there's a lot we haven't touched on, but I think we've hit the high points in terms of your role on this stakeholder committee. So I think I used more than 10 minutes, David, so I don't know whether I dare say questions.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask something. Is my understanding with when we have alternates come for to fill in for an active member that it's similar to a planning commissioner's role where they can participate in the discussion and whatnot when it comes to, or if it comes to a vote on a decision, they're not considered a voting member?
Only the folks appointed by the city council. Time for a question or two?
Questions?
Haven't we been given $50 worth of
value? Springfield can spend that on you. You're part of it.
I got the binders for free from the police department.
Okay, thank you, Bill.
Now I want to say thank you very much for your what's going to be obviously a very big job and a very important public service on the outside.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. You're up.
Okay. What I'm going to do over the next 25 minutes is to give you an overview of the highlights of the EOA and the billable land inventory. We sent that out on September 3rd for you to review. Hopefully you've had a chance to look it over. We've received a couple comments so far, and are going to be giving you some additional time to comment both tonight at this meeting and over the next couple of weeks. One of the things that you probably noticed as you read through it is that we didn't get to the punchline part that I'm sure everybody's most interested in, which is power we do and how much land do we need? Is there that's it? There's a few reasons why we couldn't get there yet. And we'll talk about that as we go through this. So where are we at in completing Project TASS? We've done the economic opportunities analysis, at least big chunks of it. We've got a draft of the commercial industrial buildable lands inventory, and we've got a draft of the economic development strategy that we submitted to staff last week and is going to be circulated. The next steps in this, obviously, are to review the draft products with the committee tonight and the decision makers. We've got a work session coming up with council in a few weeks, I think. And then finalize the draft products, and we're moving into the alternatives analysis. So by the time you see us next, we'll be hoping to get hope to get some input on some key assumptions this evening, and then hoping to bring back to you at the next meeting some real comparisons that show where the city would stand based on those assumptions and what kind of land it might need to bring into the UGB to meet its economic development objectives, if any. So the purpose is to get comments on these. And as I said, we'll take comments until the 3rd of October. And then to discuss two key assumptions that impact planning constraints and redevelopment assumptions. We presented the draft document to the TAC on September 5th and got some recommendations from them, which I'll go through as we get to the end of this. But certainly you're welcome to provide additional input and debate the direction that they recommended. So how did we develop, let's talk about the buildable lands inventory. With this, we started by establishing a land base, and essentially what we did was we used the adopted plan map for the metro plan to identify those lands that are designated for employment purposes. And the one thing that didn't come out of that filter was the Peace Health site, which had obviously been a plan amendment. So that's one major adjustment that we made to the buildable lands inventory to incorporate that in there. And so we've got this land base, essentially it encompasses all the commercial industrial land, and there was, as it turned out, there was one plan designation, the mixed-use residential, that we included in there that the TAC recommended that we take out. From a material standpoint, it doesn't make a whole lot of difference. I think it was less than 5 acres in total inventory. So once we've decided what land or determined what land falls within the land base, and the next step is to classify that land. And we essentially chose three flavors of this. Developed land, land that we look at and say is committed for this 20-year planning horizon. Vacant or partially vacant land, land that looks vacant, could be available, should be available for development, and then redevelopable, which is this broad class of land. That we discussed in a previous meeting, we use what I would say are fairly generous assumptions on redevelopment, considering the 20-year period that we're looking at, and then determine constraints and remove that constrained vacant land from the inventory. So the constraints, and one of the things I want to point out about the draft document that is in front of you for review right now is this tabular summaries in that document include both unconstrained and constrained land. So we didn't make a determination about which constraints were constraints that would restrict development or prohibitive constraints versus constraints that might be things that would complicate development. And we did get a recommendation from the TAC on which ones they think should be prohibitive constraints. In other words, those are lands that come off of the inventory because they shouldn't ever be built on versus other constraints that would simply just make development more difficult.
Who advised you on that?
The TAC.
Technical
advisory committee.
Now, what are some of the reasons that they view those as
Well, we'll get to that in just a minute. So, now the findings. What we found was 3,407 acres in tax lots that fell within these employment plan designations. And this gives you a summary of how they got classified. So of those, almost 2,000 acres ended up being classified as developed, 807 as redevelopable, and 668 as vacant. And over on this end, we've got constrained acres and unconstrained acres. Again, we didn't make a determination about developability of those constrained acres. We just said they have some sort of constraint present versus no constraint present. So for example, of the 668 acres that are vacant, 274 have constraints and 395 don't.
And Bob, can you explain, please, the methodology for determining, you have these ratios in here about improvement to land value, coverage ratios, does the tax lot information from the county or the city have coverage ratios?
No, we determined those, and if you give me a minute, George, I'll get to a more detailed discussion about how those were determined. So this is a map of the land base by classification. The ground is developed, that is potentially redevelopable, and green is vacant. So potentially redevelopable, again, is land that has some development on it, but could have development potential over this planning period.
Another definition, just for purposes of going through the next several slides. Definition of vacant.
Right. Vacant lands are lands with $10,000 of improvement value or less. And so when we look at them, they generally end up looking like greenfields. And so we worked a lot with staff on making determinations about these classifications. These maps have been vetted through several different people, including the TAC, and received quite a bit of comment on them, and now we're anticipating we'll get some comments
just,
from them.
Well, just for a little bit of clarity, just one more question. So on a vacant, the description here is currently, there could be a structure there, but its value is less than 10,000. But there could have been something there 30 years ago that's not there at all today, and that's been reclassified as vacant, or has it been historically just vacant?
Well, that's a good question. So as these things turn out, they don't end up being as simple as they might appear on the face. And so I'll start with the state definition of this. So the state basically says vacant lands are lands with no substantial improvements that are greater than a half an acre. Okay, so basically the goal line definition allows you to wipe everything that's less than half an acre out. We didn't use that definition. We basically said any parcel that's large enough to be developed can be vacant. And then they say tax lots that are, and I forget what the exact ratio is, pull it up in the administrative rule here. Equal to or larger than 5 acres where less than 1/2 acre is occupied by permanent buildings or improvements. And so that's a pretty high threshold. We used more inclusive thresholds for this. In some instances, we took tax lots that, for example, there's some tax lots that came up on the Elcock database that are part of the Roseboro operation that are actually shown as vacant on the land use. But essentially, we just included those as part of that that industrial operation and considered those to be developed, committed at this point.
Okay.
And also weighing on criteria constraint versus
unconstrained.
Yes. Quick question along those same lines for definitions. In your previous graph there, you have developed lands that there's 390 acres of constrained acres under developed land.
Not necessarily. You can build on steep slopes and in floodplains and in places that would be considered constrained by the state. The state essentially uses a very broad definition of constrained land for the purpose of the Division 9 rule. And basically what it says is development constraints means factors that temporarily or permanently limit or prevent the use of land for economic development. And the development constraints include but are not limited to wetlands, environmentally sensitive areas such as habitat, environmental contamination, slope, topography, cultural and archaeological resources, infrastructure deficiencies, parcel fragmentation, or natural hazard areas.
So about a fifth of developed acres have succeeded in that type of land.
That's right. And so again, there's a distinction between prohibitive constraints, constraints where you absolutely can't build, and constraints that are maybe limited constraints.
Joe? I noticed that you've got a little black box that looks like it's around where maybe close some improvements where it's going to be built at Marcola Meadows. The whole parcel looks like it's green and vacant. And is that kind of a placeholder knowing that there's something that's been approved and going to go in there, so you might change that? Or?
Well, that's an issue that we'll confront. Right now it is vacant, right? And so the as-of date for this, you got to keep in mind that the buildable land inventory is a snapshot in time. And so what we're looking at is what are allowable uses on the site at this point. And so that particular use is in the pipeline. And what we're doing with Marcola Meadows and the G-Cell site in terms of the capacity is we're looking at their master plans and basically allocating the amount of commercial land and employment that are anticipated for those sites.
And insofar as, you know, obviously you're going by tax line boundaries and defining some of these, and you're either all green or they're all brown or whatever, you know, like for example at the Peace Health site, the developed areas and the tax lotted kind of boundaries may not correspond with a lot of approved subdivision that's actually built on the ground as of this snapshot, if we're taking it today. So I don't know how to get you that information. Is there something further I need to give to?
I think you get down to a point where you begin to split hairs here, Philip, pretty quick. And so one of the issues that we confront on this is what is a reasonable level of accuracy in these inventories. And we certainly, in this, we've used a methodology that's more robust than any buildable lands inventory that we've done, and I've done at least a dozen of them around the state. So I understand your point. There's issues about tax lots that end up being split by plan designations. There's issues about where the boundaries of plan designations are. There's issues about where the urban growth boundary is. And so I think it's kind of complicated. Again, with the Peace Health site, the way we intend to address that is basically to use your master plan to say, here's how much housing is going to go on this, here's how much employment it will ultimately accommodate. And when we get to the final comparison chapter of the report, then that's where that will get reconciled, if that's an acceptable approach to you.
Your definition of redevelopment, right? That came out of your CAC, I think you called it.
Our definition is that we have this broad class of potentially redevelopable, and I think we want to come back to that just a minute, Lee.
Okay. I've got a question.
Sure.
It looks as if that may have been changed somewhat from the maps that we have in our packets. Is that right?
I don't think so. Shouldn't have been.
I can show you our
changes.
Which map? This is map 22.
22, yeah. And it also appears that there are some properties on there that are identified as commercial that are not, in fact, commercial.
There's the methodology we use, for example, some of these sites down here are split by plan designation, so that to preserve the integrity of the tax lots, we essentially included the tax lots on there, but that's something we'll clean up in the next round of mapping that we do. So not all of that land is actually included in the tabular summaries, even though it's shown on here, because portions of, for example, the Jasper Natron site are designated for residential uses.
I'm looking at properties in the Gateway area specifically. Maybe it's simplest just to talk to you after that.
Okay. All right, so when you do tabular summary of this, basically by plan designation or by generalized plan designation for vacant and partially vacant, got industrial, commercial, and mixed use. And on the vacant end, we've got the smallest amount of tax lots in commercial, but a fairly substantial amount that might be potentially redevelopable. This map shows vacant commercial industrial lands by developing constraints. And basically what I'm going to do now is I'm going to go through a process of overlaying all the constraints that we evaluated in this analysis. And so these are the tax lots that showed up as vacant on the inventory. So, remember to, and this is potentially redevelopable lands on the inventory. So, basically, we're looking at scattered sites, a few on the fringe, and then with the potentially redevelopable, we see a lot of stuff that starts popping up along East Main Street, in Glenwood. We made some fairly aggressive assumptions about Glenwood, given council's goal of facilitating redevelopment in Glenwood. And, some sites up in the gateway come up in that filter. So the definitions that are reflected in this map, and we have quite a bit of discussion about this at the TAC level. We struggled a lot with trying to figure out what a good definition of redevelopment potential is, and we'll start this by making a couple caveats. When we say redevelopment potential, what we're saying is these are lots that could potentially redevelop during this period, so they've got some capacity. One of the issues that came out of the TAC was access constraints along East Main. They had some concerns about that and then how that access management policy would affect about redevelopment of those sites along East Main.
Can you elaborate on that, please?
Not much, because we didn't have a chance to talk to Damon Hilton about it yet. Essentially, you brought up that comment.
The issue, I think, is there's the, because Main Street is a state highway, the ODOT has very restrictive access onto what they're doing. In fact, their predominant position is we would prefer to close it than allow you get in. If you're going to get access, you should come off of a side street. So it limits the ability to use it. We've been very tight on that. That's actually throughout the state.
I want to say that it was probably somebody on Public Works that brought up that comment.
Sure.
And basically they said, look into this because we think it's a potential problem with redevelopment on East Main.
And one thing I'd like to add to that, because there's been enough cases now that have come up that the problem with redevelopment is that it opens up, if it's significant redevelopment of an existing business or lot, then ODOT has the opportunity to come in, and their standard is 750 feet between curb cuts, which is longer than a city block, by the way. But, you know, so current development really isn't under any threat for someone to come in and say, we'd like, you have three curb cuts, we'd like to close two, or as Lee said, we'd like to have a side street, like Les Schwab had to do. But if there's a significant change in use, then ODOT is likely, in fact, to come in on East Main and say, we need a change in all of the curb cuts and access to your property. Just an ongoing state highway.
This is not the time to provide more detail, but I just want to give you a heads up on the handouts that David provided from a group that the Farm Bureau is heading up looking at redevelopment on East Main and West 11th Street, and I'll make an announcement about that sometime.
Okay, so the threshold, we essentially looked at three scenarios for redevelopability, and the first scenario we looked at was a ratio of improvement to land value of 0.3. And so that picked up some lands. And then what we did is we took a building footprint layer that Public Works GIS provided to us and overlaid that onto the tax lot boundaries and calculated the building coverage percentage. And so this particular map shows tax lots that have either the improvement to land value ratio of 0.3 to 1, or a building lot coverage ratio of less than 0.1. And so that's the threshold that we used this. And then we ran it one more time with the higher improvement to land value ratio, which was 0.5 to 1, and the lot coverage of 0.2. And so that picks up a few more things.
So this map represents the...
The median category.
The 0.5 and below one?
The 0.3 or the 0.3 and below or the buildings that have less than 10% lot coverage.
And so what happened with the 0.5 analysis that you ran? Was there, how much difference was there?
I'd have to go back through and look at the data Georgia presents and maps at one of the meetings, I think.
Well, we had talked about the template for the advisory committee.
It probably was technically wise for me a little. So, but we can distribute those maps and show you what the difference is.
Thanks.
Give you some tabular summaries of that.
Okay. Well, by that definition, what if there was a lot that had a large building that was vacant or an old building that was underused or something? Wouldn't that be redevelopable, but it wouldn't show up in your definition?
Well, we'll come back to that in a minute. We dealt with that a little different way. Okay, one of the problems with redevelopment is redevelopment potential is very location specific, and the tools that we have to evaluate where redevelopment might occur are very gross. And so in a lot of respects, it's easier to set a target, say our policy is to accommodate redevelopment at this level, and then adopt policies and other programs to encourage that to happen, rather than saying we've got some kind of magic formula that's going to identify using thresholds exactly where these things are trying to occur. I think that the part of the intent of this was to give some indication of where that potential exists, and not surprisingly, we're coming up with quite a bit of potential, or what we might call underutilized lands, you know, along your commercial strip, along East Main, in some of your industrial areas. You've got some industrial uses down in Jasper, Natron, that are not particularly intense, but still exist down there that come up on those thresholds because they're taking a lot of land, but aren't necessarily covering a lot of lot at this point.
Bill, I was just going to ask if you had, maybe you didn't see this before you came in, but the comments that Mike Kelly given us, and you know, his questions about deferments and other things that might affect that value and ratio. Maybe you've come across that or considered in other projects.
I'm
addressing them later.
We have, but you know, we're using, you can debate whether this is realistic or not, but we're using the real market value figures out of the assessment database. And so if there was deferrals on them, they come up in the assessed valuation, but not what the assessor says the market valuation is. We know there's problems with those numbers, but in the absence of getting in and doing much more detailed market studies on these sites, there's not much better to work with.
So just in sort of pictorially trying to evaluate what these standards mean, I see that, for instance, the site where Staples and Michaels were just opened is identified as a redevelopable site. It seems unlikely to me. The site that, at least in the time frame we're talking about here, also, for instance, the parcel that the Outback Steakhouse is on is identified as redevelopable. And by all accounts, that's a pretty successful operation. Also, fairly dense. I mean, the level of development there. They do certainly have a parking field, but I look at those and I question, also, by the way, the site of the New Holiday Inn is identified as redevelopable.
When you start digging into this, you end up finding out all the problems with the databases that we're working with on this. And in most of these studies, the way we would deal with redevelopment, again, Google 9 would basically allow you to ignore most of these properties. We think that based on what we've heard both from this committee and from the city council, that redevelopment is something that the community wants to look at pretty strongly. Again, as I said before, this is redevelopment potential. It's a gross indicator. And like I said, there's
when we begin to look at the assessed valuations, there's problems where you got tax lots and all of the assessed valuations on one tax lot or in the developments on another one, so it ends up being problematic for using filters like this.
Tom, I guess I have a question. When we were doing the residential study, we started out sort of the same way, but it seems like, I'm trying to remember, we got to sort of the land truthing where we actually looked at some of the big chunks and said, is that really true or not? Will we get to that in this, or is it just going to be sort of an academic?
No, I think we have to, and I think part of the direction that we need to get from the committee is how you want to deal with this. Do you want to deal with it from a supplied side approach like this and basically go through what I think will be protracted debates about what is in, what should be in and what should be out, or is it better to take it off the demand side and say we're going to target a certain amount of employment on redevelopment sites. We don't know where those are going to go, but we can pretty much say, you know, this much of it's going to come from these different types of employment, and they're generally going to get accommodated on these kinds of sites and address it that way.
It strikes me that we could go through the demand side as we would, but in the supply side, this is a place to start, but I think at the end of the day, to the extent we get there, we want to be able to look at the redevelopable lots as well as the vacant lots and say, are they really redevelopable? We want to get to the point of saying, what land base and best judgments do we have from the technical staff? What's really there? Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't look at this necessarily as a protracted debate kind of thing, but I think, say, what Richard's observing are just some factual inaccuracies that, you know, the database wouldn't kind of account for in first blush. So obviously there's, whether it's the TAC or you or, you know, your team or whatever, that, or with input maybe from the community and others on the committee that would kind of clean some of that stuff up so that it's a little more, you know, valid representation. So I assume that's okay and part of this process?
Yeah, well, it should be. And what we've done in previous projects is to essentially call together a group of stakeholders. This group could go through detailed maps, but there may be others that have familiarity with local lands that can look at the maps and provide comments and then allow us to make adjustments. When we did the countywide Kibble in 2006, that's essentially what we did. We had a developer focus group where we had people come in, and planning commissions and from development groups, and they came in and told us what they thought.
You know, that's also what the public hearing process is about. It's not just for technical committees or this committee. And where we see inaccuracies in the data, we should make our best effort to adjust them. And that's certainly something staff will want to know, so this is very good, helpful information.
How strong is the desire for redevelopment? Are we going to be encouraged to hold down the available vacant land to encourage that redevelopment?
That's a local policy decision. And so what we know right now is what we've heard from council and from the committee, and council has said that redevelopment of Glenwood is a priority, and they've said that redevelopment of downtown is a priority. The community said redevelopment of downtown is a priority, presumably by passing the urban renewal district there. In the context of the rest of the community, I think that's something we really need to get some input on. It's a very key, it's a foundational assumption of this process, how much of this is going to get considered to be redevelopable. I would say, the number of acres that we're showing in these tables represent what I would consider fairly aggressive assumptions. We're talking about 800 acres of potentially redevelopable land, and typically what we got to consider is this is a 20-year planning horizon. It's not something that extends off into the indefinite future.
If you've got more redevelopable land than you have vacant land, do you really anticipate that we're going to get our development on the reused lands?
I think some of these sites certainly could come available. I think that there's some of these larger sites that we're looking at, Jasper, Natron, definitely can come into play. This site, there's been some discussion that site may be available, and so those are some larger sites.
we know that transitions occur, and I guess part of the issue with redevelopment is from our perspective, when we look at this in the context of the UGB, replacing one store with another store with the same number of employees ends up being a wash. Doesn't make any difference. You're not accommodating any more employment. You need to have uses that intensify the employment so that you're reducing the demand for vacant land or partially vacant land. So that's the trick here. There's obviously policies, but I guess the traditional wisdom is by constraining land supply, it will foster redevelopment. There's some merit to that. The question is how much and at what cost. And part of it, I think, ends up being an issue of urban form. What does the city want? And if we have a large demand for commercial sites, does the city want to designate large commercial sites at the fringe of the community, which are implicit through UGB expansions, or do they want to try and accommodate some of that use through redevelopment?
I think there's also whether or not the community has a strategy for redevelopment, and that's what the Farm Bureau is working with the University of Oregon this term, looking at a Carter analysis, which would look at, as I said, West 11th and East Main Street. The idea is to conceptualize what it would look like to have a boulevard. There's enough right-of-way on East Main Street to do that, and the classic boulevard is, a throughput separated by median strips with slower traffic on the outside. Whereas some of you may have seen some of the work that the University of Oregon did for both Glenwood and Franklin Boulevard. And so within a month, some of that stuff will be available for this committee or people to look at, just looking at the conceptualization. And if, you take an arterial like East Main and the community invests in that strategy, then you have, much higher density of redevelopment. It's not just one commercial store for another. It also can have residential land coupled with it. So I think that's the kind of thing where my interest lies in taking as much land that's inside the UGB and maximizing the redevelopment potential, hopefully with a community strategy behind it. I just think, again, that's a way that it's not just helter-skelter. It's if you come up with a plan, you can actually guide it.
I don't disagree with you, George, on the commercial side. I'm not sure that I would agree with the industrial side.
Sure.
That actually has a lot of appeal. I've advocated for a long time that the city take over Main Street, get it out of the highway category, sort of west of 52nd Street. But so far, the city hasn't seemed to have a real interest in doing that.
Well, this working group that I've been a part of is actually discussions with ODOT, and I think there is real potential there.
Well, I'll tell you, ODOT would love to get there. That's not the issue.
Well, one comment I would make on that, and this is, I think this is a strategic issue, is we've included everything north of Franklin and in Glenwood, even those properties that didn't come up in the threshold, just because we think that that's part of the city's objective. We're not quite sure what to do with downtown. We just included those properties that came into it. But the issue becomes one of how many initiatives can the city push forward at once, and what is that strategy? And so if Glenwood is the strategy, can you be moving forward with the strategy on Main Street at the same time? And these things are going to require some public investment to happen.
Just a question. So you considered the properties north of – it's just a request first. It'd be really helpful if you had the streets layer turned on these maps so you can better identify where you are in the world. So all of those, that strip in Glenwood there is just north of Franklin Boulevard, and you didn't include the property south as redevelopment potential?
I'm only the ones that came up in with the thresholds.
Okay. So among the constraints that you look at, I know from long ago project in Glenwood, that there's some utility constraints there too in terms of redevelopment potential, stormwater
availability of stormwater access. So is that kind of part of the constraints part that you'll look at too in the redevelopment potential?
That's part of what we're talking with Public Works about on the short-term supply issue, folks. We don't, while the state considers those engineering issues to be potential long-term or serviceability potential long-term constraint, we're considering them more a short-term issue that can be resolved through planning and functional plans.
You mentioned a couple of council priorities in terms of redevelopment. It's my understanding that the council also has a priority to have development-ready sites available as part of its strategy. So those and aggregation is a difficult way to achieve that. Redevelopment is a difficult way to achieve that, as the city recently demonstrated in Glenwood. So does that drive? I mean, you're talking about
that is part of the identified site needs, and that's a little later on in the presentation, which I might not get to the end of if we can talk about in this discussion.
Yeah, I promised to move us along, and I haven't been there very
well. This is important.
Don't look at us. Just keep going.
Yeah. Well, we anticipated. I mean, this was one of the key things until you guys jumped straight to the punchline. I said at the beginning, we needed your input on what constraints to include and what redevelopment assumptions to make in this and have to address these. And so this is an important discussion, and it may be that we don't resolve it tonight, but I'm hoping we can move through. So if you let me continue through this, we'll get to the end, and then you guys get the big picture on how all this fits together and how we're looking at this. And so the question with development constraints is, are they absolute or partial? We did get a recommendation from the TAC on this. I'm going to go through what these look like. So this is the floodway, and the TAC recommended that the floodway be an absolute constraint. No development in the floodway.
Where's the floodway?
It's the gray overlay here.
Oh, okay.
So there's a large site up here that's, that site's probably 50 acres. It's almost completely in the floodway. So those lands would come off. Or at least those floodway constrained portions of the lands would come off. The next thing we've got, in the right direction, is floodplain. And the TAC recommended that the floodplain not be considered an absolute constraint. The development, the city allows development in the floodplain, and that those lands that are in the floodplain continue to be considered available or not constrained to the extent they can't be built on. Let's see if I can remember the order I put these on here. The next one is wetlands, and I've got, you can see it. They're a little difficult to see on here. This also includes some water bodies. We have the big wetland down here in Jasper Natron, and the mill race is coming up here. You've got some ponds here. And so what they said, what the TAC recommended was, for the most part, that wetlands be considered absolute constraints, but that some areas like these ponds, these settling ponds that Weyerhaeuser has, may end up being drained at some point becoming available. So there might be some hand adjustments to that analysis for
so light purple Jasper Natron. The bigger one.
Yeah, this is just a parcel that's light medium industrial. So it's just a vacant parcel that's
It's not a constraint
area. No. And then the next thing we put on here was riparian areas. So we've got the some of the canals here that are showing. And the TAC recommended, I get this right, that riparian areas are absolute constraints. So those setbacks be taken out of the inventory and will be considered unbuildable. And then the next one after this is the greenway. And the TAC recommended that the greenway not be considered an absolute constraint because it's a permitting issue, and that's consistent with what the administrative rules say.
I'm sorry, did you say slopes was not absolute?
We're not there yet.
Okay.
So we got the greenway.
Yeah. Can you go back to the right greenway?
I know it's hard to see on this, but the ones that end up inside the UGB are primarily the drainage canals that are showing up. You've got some that are out here in the eastern portion.
Do you have this map here?
Yeah.
Okay. It's the same slide as that one.
Yep.
Just for clarity, riparian is the setback.
Yes.
And it's 75 feet.
I'm going to defer to staff on that one.
The riparian zone is 75 feet back on top of the bank.
Yes, I think it varies some depending on which water bodies in the riparian area they're talking about.
Okay.
There's a range.
50 to 75. The riparian, what exactly is that?
What is a riparian area?
Yeah,
oh, what is
sure
a riparian
what is.
Riparian area is an area that's adjacent to water bodies, so usually has vegetation that supports water bodies, fish, or water
bodies. Could you give me an example of one of those?
Trees.
Okay. Like by the water? Then? Okay. All right.
It's essentially a class of vegetation that is that grows in areas that have more water than upland areas.
Thank you.
It's going to be the protection, vegetative protection to keep dirty stuff moving in the water.
Erosion.
Temperature.
Cool water.
So there are constraints on the riparian areas within the UGB, but not adjacent to the UGB, current UGB?
We haven't mapped those yet.
Okay.
We haven't even begun looking at lands outside the UGB. Anything that's in direction on what we're assuming inside the UGB before we start doing alternatives.
We did decide wetland was not an absolute constraint.
We did say it was an absolute constraint, but there might be some adjustments to it. And then the last one that we've got here is slopes. And we use an assumption of slopes over 15% for this. The state doesn't give clear guidance in Goal 9. In Goal 10 for the housing part, they do give clear guidance, and that is that you can consider that anything over 25% slope to be undevelopable. The data layers that staff gave us are so accurate that we're seeing slope constraints coming up on the sawdust pile over the MF side. So what we're saying is that those slopes...
Mount Kingsford?
Yeah. Those slopes would generally be considered constraints, but we might want to make some area-specific adjustments to recognize the quality of the data probably exceeds some of the areas that we...
Most practically now, we're looking at commercial and industrial lands. It's really hard to build large buildings on both sides.
Yeah, I think Hynix
seemed to do a pretty good job.
Huh?
Hynix did a good job.
They did do a good job. Very expensive. And they had a little bit of problem, people's perception about a building there.
Bob, in the Natron area, I can't quite decipher this. Where the dark purple one is, and it looks like there's cross-hatching.
Yeah.
Are those slope constraint?
Yeah, those would fall within the slope constraint.
Okay. So what did you do again with that? Did you remove it or not?
All of these constraints that I showed are wrapped up into the summary numbers right
so
now.
So that says constraint.
Yeah, so in the what I just told you was the TAC recommendation, which was, let's see if I get this right again, floodway is out. There was no debate about floodways.
So that number, those acres disappeared.
They would disappear.
Not constrained or unconstrained, they're gone.
They'll be unbuildable. Okay, so right now we're not making a distinction between buildable and constrained.
Okay.
What we want to do is make a distinction between buildable or buildable constrained and unbuildable constrained. And so what we're saying, TAC recommendation was floodway would be unbuildable constrained. Wetlands, for the most part, would be unbuildable constrained. Slopes would be unbuildable constraint for the most part, and riparian areas would be unbuildable constraint. Other things like the greenway floodplain, one of the things that staff brought up that we haven't mapped yet is BPA easements. Those are all considered
constraints, but not unbuiltable constraints. So there are things that might increase permitting costs or make development more difficult, but not prohibit development.
Okay, so just final clarification. We have in this tabular form here the, for example, campus industrial 36.3 acres, constrained 25.3, unconstrained 11. So those add up. But what you're saying is within those constrained acres of 25.3, there potentially are some that are unbuildable.
Right.
They didn't get kicked out.
We didn't kick them out yet because we're looking for a recommendation from the committee before we do that.
Okay, thanks.
So right now, when you look at the constraints on there, they don't make a distinction about what's unbuildable.
Okay.
So I would like to get a recommendation on the committee if we can this evening about whether you'd like to go forward with a TAC recommendation or propose something else so that we can go run the numbers and come back with something that reflects what those constraints, the prohibitive constraints, actually are.
So you want to get through this whole thing before we go back?
That would be helpful, I think. Okay. So here's this. This, I'm not going to go over this. I just did it. So let's go over the EOA really quickly. Some statistics that I summarized in a previous one. Services are increasing, retail decreased over the 2007, manufacturing decreasing, government decreased. So services are going to be the dominant industry, and they have specific site needs that exist, but there's also continued demand from these other kinds of employers. These are the things that you went over before. I'm going to skip through this and get to the interesting part of this. We did an employment growth forecast for Springfield, and we're using the 2010 to 2030 increment because we think it's going to be 2010 by the time any of this stuff actually gets adopted. And what we did was we used a safe harbor approach that was based off of the safe harbor methodology for the population forecast. And so this is, it's sort of built on some assumptions that the safe harbor population forecast is going to get adopted and move forward. Essentially what we did was we took this this forecast and we allocated it into building types. And then we associated those building types with site needs, which is the approach that the state requires. Now, let's talk about how we diced up those 13,500 employees. We made assumptions, and we think these are very aggressive assumptions for Springfield, that some jobs will not need any new employment land. The first class of jobs is new jobs that will locate on non-employment land. And if you recall, way back to last spring, when we were presenting some of the statistics, I showed you a map that showed the location of all employers in Springfield. And the conclusion we came up with based on the analysis of that data was 14% of the employment in Springfield was located essentially in residential zone. Some of it was in parks, and in parks and open space zones, some of that was landlords. So as a baseline, we assumed that 14% of all new employment in Springfield would locate in those areas. Okay, so none of those will require new employment land, nor will they create demand for new residential land. They're integrated with housing. We also assume that some new jobs will locate in existing build space. So the comment was, what did you do about vacant buildings? Well, we didn't go out and do a vacancy analysis. It might be interesting, but it's a point in time, and we know that vacancies are going to cycle over the period the buildings are going to come and go and so on. What we said was 10% of all new employment will locate in buildings or on tax lots that are already identified as developed in this. And so, 10% of the jobs are going into buildings that could be vacant now, but look like they're developed on the land, or buildings that already have employment in them but somehow accommodate more employment through intensification of uses or development of new buildings in parking lots, is like what's happened out in Gateway, at the Gateway Mall for the past decade, et cetera. And so what this ends up doing is saying that 24% of all the new employment in Springfield is not going to require buildable land. So this doesn't address the redevelopment portion of it, but it addresses what broadly what we would call the infill portion of it.
Okay, so that leaves of the 13,000 some odd jobs, that leaves 10,177 that will require employment land. So then what we did was we did a site needs analysis, which is required by Bolton, and this is suggestive of the methodology we use. What we started with was looking at the relationship of employment by site size, so we got a distribution of current employment by site size, and then we allocated future employment by site size by making some assumptions about what that might look like in the future. Took the average employees per firm for these, and they've got a number of needed sites, and created a range of needed sites for those employers. And so this essentially is where we end up with on these ranges. And rather than saying there's an exact number, we chose to include a range. And there were questions before about large sites, 3 to 6 sites that are 20 to 50 acres, 2 to 4 sites greater than 50 acres. And when we say greater than 50 acres, that's kind of an open-ended category. The city could say we want to try and find a 200-acre site to accommodate a major employer. If you look through the comments that Jack Robert provided, he says there's interest in those kinds of sites, but there's none of them in this region right now. It's certainly something that you could instruct us to look at in the alternatives analysis. It might be challenging to find some that have all the site criteria that these industries are looking for. So long-term site needs, when we distilled this down, and I think there's still some flexibility in what the ultimate assumptions end up being, but we basically identified these by the type of buildings that would go on them so that we can then, in the next iteration of this, in the last chapter of the report, begin to talk about the site requirements of these different building types. This is an approach that is used by Metro in Portland. And then to compare those with the sites that the city has. So there's another step here in the comparison that's not addressed in the report at all right now, and that is we've done the inventory, and for a moment let's just say that we go through a process of review and get comments from various stakeholders and we get it right so that everybody says, yeah, we can live with it, we think it's more or less right. Not all those acres may be appropriate for the kind of development that the city is potentially going to get over this period of time. So what we need to do is compare the site characteristics of employers, potential employers, with the sites that you've got to see what that match looks like.
Yeah, I'm sorry again, I'm just reminded that I leave at 7:30. There's a couple of things here, I don't get this in, I want to do it now. First of all, it's kind of interesting that the future jobs, 75% of them are going to be private sector driven. So, and then the rest kind of public sector, and I think there's a distinction about what drives both of them. Some are, like George is talking about planning and all this kind of stuff, seems to lend itself more to the public sector, and the market kind of dictates a lot of the private sector. The other thing is some help from David here about the safe harbor. I'm not going to let that go. The safe harbor figure is 1% growth, correct?
Modify
is a nice word.
You could correct me.
Oh, correct.
I kind of do. I'm looking it up as I'm talking. But the safe harbor employment projection we used wasn't using the employment, the population safe harbor. So we're not assuming that employment will grow at the same rate as population. We used a different safe harbor that allows us to assume that employment will grow at the rate that it's forecast for all of Bay County, which is 1.4% annually. So it's a little higher when we're talking about the population, which is, I think, 1.1% of employment.
Right, yeah,
1%.
Well, I that's good to know. I mean, I think at 1%, if it were that, and it isn't, you know, the 10,000 and change new jobs, at 1.7, which I thought David at the presentation of the Rotary Club, you kind of said, our middle ground growth would be about 1.7.
Yeah, what I was talking about there was with the residential land study last fall, we had went to the council, we talked about different growth scenarios. We had a low, medium, and a high. and that was for population forecasting. We had 1.3 was the low, 1.7 was the middle, 2.1 was the high. Since then, we have been working with the county on the population forecasting issue, and right now the city just filed a what's called a post-acknowledgement plan amendment application to go with the Safe Harbor population forecast, which is actually lower than the 1.3, it's right around 1%.
Just my point is, in terms of looking out at 20 years and things like that, the difference between 1.1 and 1.7 is, you know, significant. It almost is doubling the number of anticipated jobs needed, new lands needed. And so I just think that's another one of those deals that when we come to the end of the road here, I would think the committee, and maybe it's the tax attack committee that needs to do it, that a recommendation to the city council be a little bit more realistic than, I know what the safe harbor's for, and I understand all the work that would go into really figuring this out, but it would behoove us to really try to get a growth rate that is as accurately believable, even though, you know, anything can happen when you go into a tailspin or something, because if you're using that to dictate how many jobs you could anticipate and how much land therefore you'll need, it really is important to buy thousands of jobs over time, a lot of jobs.
Yeah, but I don't disagree with that. Part of the issue, though, in terms of getting it done, and one of the advantages of using the safe harbor is, at least it appears to be, although there's some controversy, it's accepted and not challengeable, as opposed to you can get in, as we've experienced in this community a lot of times, a lot of debate over higher forecasts.
I agree. And, you know, just the difference between what we heard at Rotary and what we heard is 7,000 jobs is over the $10,000 thing. I know what you're saying, Lee, because you got to defend your figure if you're not in the safe harbor. But you pay a price if you think that you're pretty far away from what reality is just to be in the safe harbor. And I just want us to all know that when we go forward to think in terms of that. Because the recommendation, now this recommendation can be based, you've got a population growth figure that will have to be adopted for the final recommendation. You can't say, well, we've got a safe harbor figure, but here's a figure that we really think is closer to the truth. But when it comes time to make a recommendation of future jobs, it's just whatever we can do to make that number as accurate as possible.
Well, let me make, I don't want to complicate this, a couple points. One is the safe harbor, you know, the best reminder of what we actually did, that we used is not in any way tied to the population forecast. So I don't think that the figure that we're using in this is a challengeable figure. You could direct us as a committee to use a higher figure. And there's probably arguments that could be made that would justify a higher growth rate. But that also creates potential for discussion about that, and then it creates a higher burden for.
So 1.4, for the purposes of the job growth, you use 1.4?
Yes. For employment.
For employment, okay. Thank you.
Okay. So, to the bottom line, how much land does the city need right now? We can't give you a definitive answer because we need to get input from you on these assumptions about infill, redevelopment, and constraints. But it does appear to us that the city's got a deficit of larger sites right now, and that's probably going to be something that we need to take a closer look at in the next phase of this analysis. So the TAC assessment recommendations that we got were to accept the infill assumptions of 14% for land that's not going to, or employment that won't locate on lands that are designated for employment, and 10% that will locate in existing build space. They suggested we use the proposed redevelopment assumptions with the following changes. I get the sense that you might give us some different direction on this. And to discount the development potential on Highway 126, or at least to consider that because of ODOT's restrictions. Okay, so we got a few comments to date on this. We got comments from Jack Roberts and a set from Mike Kelly. And I just want to summarize what they said, and then we can really get into the discussion.
And some comments that Jack made was potential for employment in call centers. He commented that he thought that we'd mischaracterize that, that there was more potential than the report reflected right now, and that he suggested that we amend it to note that there is quite a bit more potential in this region based on what other call center clusters are doing in the United States. Need for larger manufacturing sites. In Jack's letter, he provided a list of 10 contacts. They were lost in 2008 because of lack of sites, and they were 50 to 200 acres. And the need for land use buffers for with the industrial sites, problems with the existing industrial use and compatibility with surrounding uses or eventual commercial uses. And then issues about redevelopment assumptions. These particular comments came from Mike, and somebody brought them up a little while ago. Some sites may be redeveloped but have artificially low land value. I think the suggestion made by the committee and probably articulated by Lee was, let's get those maps out there and have folks look at them, modify them to the extent we can. And then, Mike also made a comment that it wasn't clear how the committee works and includes the EOA. And I would say there's lots of ways the committee works. It includes the EOA. It's influenced in the context of how we've allocated lands. It's influenced in the context of the economic development opportunities that are reflected in the document, in many more ways that are probably more subtle than you'd like. A lot of this ends up being, unfortunately, us trying to toe the line between meeting the state requirements and reflecting the community's desires. So that's it.
And I've got to go.
Take your last shot.
Okay, I talked to Mike. Number five is more or less not, it's kind of how you characterize it, but I think what his point was for the benefit of the members of the committee as if there was a little bit more clarity about those subtle influences for those, for all of us, frankly, we haven't all made the meetings, and I think he actually said in his comments, I apologize for not being a good attender, but I think where you have seen influence from discussions here, those would be maybe something that get pointed out. And then the last one, on the Jack Roberts assessment that we lost 10, that's really not accurate. A lot of those leads I'm somewhat familiar with, and they weren't really serious leads. They didn't go anywhere in the state, and there's a lot of places that have those properties, and some of them came here, and we frankly don't have, for example, the power. And a couple of them had water considerations, so I just would be careful about that and saying that if we had a bunch of large sites, we would have had 10 customers here. That wasn't really the case, and I wish it were that risk of interest around here, but most of them, it was very cursory, and we didn't have a lot of things that needed. So, apologize for leaving early this week.
Other comments?
Bob, tell me how you want us to comment on some of these things. We got a deadline by October 3rd. What's the most, or data? Do you want us to send an email and distribute it to the whole group, or?
The deadline for the final deadline for us to incorporate this so that we can send it to the Council Planning Commission will be October 3rd. And I would recommend you email that to me, and then I can forward that to Jack Northwest. Do you all as a committee want to see everybody's comments emailed to the whole group, or would you prefer just
I think that would be helpful when we can summarize and send them out by email. People would like to see those.
Okay, so to clarify our intent, George, with this particular deadline, is what we want to do is get all the comments from the committee and then take the ones that we think are the real substantive ones to do the work session with Council and Planning Commission and say, here are the big issues that either the committee made recommendations on or the committee didn't make recommendations on, and maybe you could give the committee some guidance, or maybe you just remanded it back to them to
work on it some more.
We're having a joint planning commission city council work session on October 27th.
So, it may be helpful just to start out on the first one, because you listed some things up there and just kind of talk through it a little bit, and people can find additional ones if they want. I think one of the basic ones that you need direction on, if the committee feels comfortable, is do we support the idea of using the technical recommendations and definitions on the strengths?
Right.
That, well, at least those 2 points right there, I think, are part of that.
I'm particularly concerned about the tax recommendation about discounting the redevelopment potential on East Main Street. And I'm not sure how to deal with that. I think that some of the work that's going to come out of the UVO workshop would be really informative for this committee to be able to see the conceptualization, to understand the conversations that have occurred with ODOT. Because I think that is really a key part of the commercial plans, potential redevelopment for Springfield. So I'm in a quandary here. If you I think it would be beneficial for the broader group or part of them to have access to that.
Which timeline?
Well, the storyboards will be done by our next meeting, and I think there'll be. There'll be all kinds of things he's invited guests, world authorities on multi-way boulevards to come to town. I think people might be interested in hearing some of that. So I'm just not sure, it's not all going to happen by October 3rd.
George, is that the same one that they had an open house at Roaring Rapids?
Because that was on Glenwood, was that
Glenwood? Yeah, the city has a project where we actually work on actually a concept for commercial multi-level Franklin Boulevard in Glenwood.
Right.
Yeah, I think we're talking about
the idea is to take that concept and utilize it for looking at East Main Street between, I think it's 22nd or 24th and 56, I don't remember what the boundaries were.
Were you able to, because I know some of the businesses there were kind of running scared because it kind of dug into to where their establishments were. Were you guys able to get together with them and kind of work out?
I think there's two different things. One was the stuff that the city actually did for Glenwood with specific recommendations. This is more conceptualization, looking at a different stretch of 126.
Okay.
That would be from, I think, as I said, 24th to 56. So it's East Main Street.
Sorry about that.
Yeah. So if you drive along that, you can see there's a lot of redevelopment potential. There's a lot of right of way that would lend itself. The property owners haven't been involved at this point because it's just conceptualization. But ODOT has been involved in discussions about this.
Does the process lend itself to sort of moving forward with the constraints and then amending that as we get farther down?
Well, I guess I would make a proposal to you for consideration, and that would be to table the discussion about redevelopment for tonight, allow us to circulate the maps and have them reviewed. Update that information, and then I guess George can work with David to figure out how that might plug into this process, but it seems like this redevelopment issue is a big enough issue that it's not going to resolve tonight. I can see that for sure. But I think these other two issues, the infill assumptions, I'd like to at least see if he's willing to give us a blessing on that, and then the issues about constraints, if you can give us direction on that, then we can move forward with those two pieces.
I want to make sure I understand the first one. The 14% and 10% are really a reflection of what has happened in the past.
14% is, the 10% is reflective of what we've seen in some other communities. The problem is that
the data aren't good enough for us to look at how much.
Really, what you're saying is that
we're just saying
some of the businesses are just going to grow and it's not going to take additional space.
Right, exactly.
Symantec hires, fills out, or Royal Caribbean fills out another 1,000 employees. They're not going to build another building for that.
Exactly, that's going to account for 1,300 employees over this.
Does it also include people, business owners looking out of their home?
The first one does.
4-10%.
Sorry.
I guess just a couple of questions. In the slide you had about employment growth opportunities, and we skipped over that, but I presume is education considered one of those, or is it implicit in one of the bulleted points that you had?
Yeah, it was one that, that both the committee and council gave us direction on.
It is, let's just say, I mean, if employment growth opportunities, education is a, you know, an area that presumably there would be some growth. Would then say expansion of educational facilities of one kind or another that are employment generating in and of themselves would be part of that non-employment land? Let's just say if a school site is no longer needed by the school district and it becomes then redeveloped as some other kind of a site for a different kind of educational use. Or even a new site, you know, it's Pioneer Pacific College or something like that. So I mean, I'm not sure how, you know, what you're calling non-employment. Is that
everything
the Lamaline and the government services designation and
primarily residential, but it's also open space and parks.
Which tests us? We did a little bit.
I was pushing up 14% if I could. The 14% represents, as I understand it, current employment in non-employment land. How consistent is that number with the city's policies regarding employment in non-employment land? In other words, does that represent a bunch of home occupations that are really frowned on by the city and might be reduced in some future enforcement action?
Well, I would defer to the city. What I will say is that it's lower than what we've seen in some other communities. In Ashland, they had somewhere on the order of 25%, Grants Pass at 20%.
One of my comment would be there's a number of businesses that the city likes to have because of the residential areas, and that's okay. There's a small percentage of those that we don't like to have, but occasionally happens to be trying to enforce the rules. But usually there's a good number of that out there. There's also businesses that are in non-conforming uses that have been in the lands that have been out there for a long time. So they're not in, they might be in residential, you know, things that have been zoned residential, but it hasn't occurred yet. So that would be the non-conforming use of that part
of the system. Are you at 14 to the public?
Yeah, that feels about right.
Another way to think of it too is there's a lot of people that run their business out of their house where they may not need an actual space for their business. So say if somebody's an electrician or a plumber and, you know, they park their van at their house where they live, but then, you know, they receive phone calls and go out to different job sites to do a service of some sort. So that would fall into this category.
Does it include people that are perhaps national sales people or pharmaceutical reps, that kind of thing?
Yeah, and there's
your office is technically someplace else, but they have a company on their house.
And there's reason to believe that that certainly will continue into the future and may actually, there may be trends that boost it up in some respects.
We're also seeing startups, often start. So small businesses are home and eventually they get to the garage and they're still successful, they might get to an actual commercial site.
Well, I think for assumptions that 10% is reasonable, but I think the reality is probably a lot higher than that. There's a lot of vacant buildings in town that can be used for jobs or businesses.
Some of those sites would be redevelopment sites, I think, you know, again, keep in mind that these vacancies end up being cyclical, and we just consider them a wash, and that'll kind of fluctuate throughout this planning period. We're taking a long-term look at this.
Actually, the vacancy rate is not that high.
What was the commercial?
I think it is. Yeah, that new
Dan might.
All I can tell you is there's a lot of office space for rent on Main Street. A lot of square footage. Well, take your pick, yeah. In the redevelopment area downtown, of course.
So that touches on the question of redevelopment versus vacancy and how we reconcile those two pieces.
Yeah, the way that Metro does it in Portland is they roll it all into one assumption and they call it refill.
Refill? That actually makes some sense. I don't know how you deal with that. Well, does anybody have problems with the first one? Good problems, or does that seem about right? You got it. What else? The redevelopment, it seems like you're going to come back with something on that. I personally, I would feel most comfortable with that. I didn't have problems with your assumptions as long as that we're going to take a look at those and see how realistic those are. And I personally don't have any trouble with having staff look at that and making a professional judgment call.
Well, I think we'll seek some outside input on some of those sites. Certainly, one of the things that we've done in the past that is really important is people make comments on specific sites rather than just taking them off the inventory report, what the comments are, so that that's all available to you. There's certainly adjustments that can be made in this, and probably some, you know, there's going to be a debate about what's redevelopable and what's not over this planning period, but let's clean it up first and then move there. I think one of the things George suggested that we can do is come back and show you some scenarios based on some different thresholds after we get this cleaned up a little bit to show you what the differences look like.
Can we get a bigger map so we can go back to looking at that?
So again, I'm sorry to be thick about this, but just as with transportation being a potential constraint, you know, in East Springfield, the Glenwood and kind of utility infrastructure, be it in Jasper Nature. I mean, it's sort of assumed that in the long run of this 20-year planning horizon, those problems will essentially be solved.
That is the way the state encourages you to think about it.
I guess, you know, I mean, I'd like to heartily buy into that, but, you know, Glenwood has not developed thus far in the short term as much as despite all these planning efforts, partly because of the lack of funding to do all these infrastructure improvements that would really make the area pop. So
it's a game of chicken, too. Who's going to do it first? You know.
And realistically, those same issues exist with the areas that you're going to expand into. Somebody's got to put the bill to get that infrastructure out there. And without having done any analysis, it's not clear that it's going to be cheaper to service Glenwood versus other places.
Redevelopment is really hard to do. A lot of times, like downtown, if you got into the property cheap enough price, you're getting the return on the investment is probably as high or higher than if you go in and reinvest and try to build something. So the economics aren't there. Would you?
I had a question about one of the employment clusters that I didn't see identified. We often talk in Springfield about the large concentration of hotel rooms that we have in the Gateway area in particular. And I was curious whether that was contemplated as a cluster, and whether the demands stemming from that, the increase in that, potential increase in that cluster was contemplated in any way. Does it fall under retail? Or?
No, it falls under tourism and travel.
So I didn't see
the short answer is yes.
It was included. Okay.
John, one comment on Bill's concern about having enough infrastructure in the area for development. In 1988, we did not have improvements on Gateway Street. They came in, Gateway Mall came in 1993, and we put the infrastructure in for the industrial Sony ride. 2002-2003, a small back office kind of group that we have in the city, like we have in the area. So in 20 years, you've got East Health, River Bend campus, the campus industrial is two-thirds or half to two-thirds filled. Gateway is a going reasonably well. So I guess in 20 years you can see those kinds of things, even in the areas that were stymied for development.
Just a point of information here, Bob. If like on this, for 10%, if for some reason during the next 2 months it comes to somebody's attention that they've got real heartburn over that, they come back with some reasonable alternative, I assume you guys, I don't know what the time frame is here, but I'm assuming that you're open to adjustment of some of these things if there's a compelling reason to do that. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think absolutely.
Well, that's true right up until adoption. There's nothing set in concrete until the city council adopts it.
And there's no hearing. There's no hearing.
You can always update the plan.
I'm just kind of, this is like a process check here. So, you know, we're all part of this. If someone, you know, says, wait a second, I remember 10%, and maybe there's some other reason for it. It could be any of this stuff.
What?
One
constraints.
Constraints.
So the TAC recommendation.
TAC recommendation. Constraints.
But you go back up to it.
I just, my personal preference is to leave a floodplain development out of it. I think that's a can of worms, unless the city has. There's issues with flood maps. Most of this, at least, you know, within the UGB, most of the mapped floodplain stuff is along the McKenzie as you get into the potential UGB expansion is going to be in the Willamette. The flood maps, I don't think, are as accurate as they could be, so my personal preference would be to avoid that.
Well, what was the nature of the discussion on the floodplains?
Not absolute.
Yeah, basically the nature was city policy currently allows development within floodplains, so they're not absolute, therefore include them in the inventory.
How successful?
I'm kind of surprised about that in commercial industrial. With residential, you can do it. With commercial, industrial, it's tough to do.
No, you just push the building up in the air.
Push the water on the neighbor, yeah.
As long as our building will increase.
I've built any high foundation down the bank of Buffalo Park in Glen.
And he builds on the skate.
So, for my part on this issue, until the city's policy has changed, I think it's really difficult to justify not including those lands.
George has a concern, the one hand, Richard's on the other. I'm sort of in the middle of it, so anybody else have a point?
I support George's perspective, or I support having floodplains be an absolute constraint.
I mean what?
Floodplains be an absolute constraint. Or at least like to hear how the city decides on, you know, when and how to build a floodplain. What sort of criteria goes into deeming the plain buildable or not?
Well, you know, I guess I'd go back on the other side of saying that I would agree with TAC on this. And, you know, on the map that you had there, you showed a floodplain going right through the Sony building. Sony developed on, so I mean, it actually isn't. Obviously wasn't a constraint to build that building.
And until the water came into it.
Well, I think that was actually a different matter entirely, but because that part of the building that had the water go into it was built at grade below, not a foot above the 100-year floodplain, so they didn't build that portion of the building to meet city policy. Had they, the building wouldn't have gotten wet. Likewise, you know, with the whole riverbend development, you know, we did 3 miles of floodplain analysis and looked at not only the development and full build out of that whole campus, the full build out of that whole campus, plus the entire 3 miles of affected area of the riverfront and full build out of the entire Springfield and UGB. We would have had to have mitigated on site the impacts of development. Have we caused a significant effect
that by the policy of the city of increasing flood elevations off-site by a flood. And I think the development increase, the increase as a result of the development of the riverbend site is less than an inch. The development the increase associated with development of the entire UGB was, I think, around 4 inches. So, you know, I think there are ways to mitigate the development in a floodplain, and they do so, you know, kind of consistent with established policies the city has. And I'd say, you know, you look at it on a site-by-site basis, and there are provisions by which the city can say, you can do this if you have to mitigate your effects or otherwise account for them, which is kind of what's happened thus far.
Let me just question that, and I want to make sure that we're looking at this correctly. If we excluded in the assumptions, that doesn't affect the fact that I'm zoned the way it's zoned now. Somebody could come into the city under the existing city policies and still build on it. The effect of excluding it just means that we would have to, if we have a demand for more land, we would just create a demand for finding more land someplace else. It wouldn't take it out of the inventory.
It will reduce the amount of land that comes up as vacant and potentially redeveloped. And it may reduce the quite significantly.
I understand your point, Lee, but I also have had occasion to experience that maps developed for one purpose have been applied to other purposes, and they're often can be misunderstanding about what those maps and documents intended after they're adopted. So I think that's a potential consequence.
Okay.
I could live with the issue of within applying this concept to lands that are already inside the UGB. My main concern is as we move forward and look towards future development, which means, you know, public money is going to be spent on infrastructure development costs. I just don't think it's a good use of public resources to cite future growth in the floodplain. So I think Richard's absolutely right. Anyone, you know, they own land that's inside the UGB now, someone can come into the city and apply to it. The city will be on a case by case, but if we're looking forward and trying to make thoughtful decisions about future siting of our employment facilities, I don't think that should be a good use.
That's another point. That's different than what's being used for. This only applies within the UGB, correct?
But I'm assuming that, you know, when we go forward, you're going to look at constrained lands and we're going to do the same analysis. So that I would just...
For when you get into the alternative.
Yeah, so we're having this discussion now. I'm raising this as a concern.
As a practical matter, raising this as a possibility, I'm not saying it's a certainty. If the city identifies a deficit of large size, it seems very unlikely to me that you're going to meet that need on exceptions areas. The city's probably going to have to look at some agricultural lands to accommodate that need. And so the issue is going to be, what criteria do you use to identify what are appropriate sites? And there'll be criteria that are based on the type of development that the city is seeking. So it might be you need flat sites, they gotta have good access and they have to have infrastructure and that kind of thing. There may be other criteria that are environmentally based. You don't want wetlands on them, you don't want wetlands, et cetera.
I'm not sure, just concerned, it seemed like you were okay with using the criteria for doing the land value measure within the UGB.
Well, for the I just don't think that we have an alternative. I think that the city now, building is allowed in the floodplain, and there is a potential problem there. And so I just say let that go forward. Let the city do their job when it comes time to evaluating those applications, but I think if we have a choice about using future ones, I think we should leave it off the table.
applicant, I don't know how you want to make that decision, whether you want to do it now or give guidance to them.
It's another time when we get to look in the future. We don't need to make that decision now.
No, we'll come back with a series of maps that don't really have any study areas identified, but look at attributes of lands outside of the UGB that show exceptions areas, soils, floodplains, slopes, etc.
Are you okay with that?
So this is constraints and non-constraints within the current UGB?
That's what we're discussing this evening, yeah.
Anybody else object to that? Okay, we've got that one for you. What's next? You got 10 minutes. You got one we can tackle in 10 minutes?
I think you have two options. You can either go around and see if there are other comments on the report that folks want to share with us, or we can talk a little bit about what's going to come up next with the alternatives analysis. And I'm going to ask Dave this, but it may be that we can defer that next steps discussion until the next meeting also. I'm not sure that we'll be diving into that right away. I think there's probably another round of discussion.
Let's make sure that everybody has a chance to make whatever comments they want to make now. Again, we can put things in writing to, who do we send them to?
Dave?
Send
them to me.
So you want to start? Would you like to start?
Actually, if I could add in based on that. So when people send me their comments, I just send them to me, and then I can compile them all together and send them out to the group so they have to be seized for what other people are saying.
Who wants to start?
Start over here. To start by saying that I appreciate the presentation and the conversation today. And then just for future meetings with regards to some of these maps, and Bill mentioned this earlier, so if we could just get some, you know, landmarks or street names on here when we're looking at a particular aspect, that would be helpful.
Okay.
I think everything was good. We discussed about everything. That 10% number is still running around in my head. I'm picturing all these downtown places that are vacant. I'm picturing places on Main Street that are vacant or well underused and could be developed as is. And that counted as redevelopable, right? Because they can reuse it. So I'm thinking that number could be a lot higher than it, since the new jobs can come with existing buildings.
I agree with Guy, and also that 14%, I think that that's actually smaller than what the reality of it is. I think it's a lot higher. I meet people every day that have their own business, and they love it, and they're successful, and they want to have their home, and it's doing well. And so I think that, for me, I think that 14% is low. And I agree with George on the future footprint. I think what they've made is absolute unbuildable in some of those waterways is
Jim?
I had a lot of little notes to discuss, and we did very well, and thanks Bob for making sure we got everything discussed that we needed to. Yeah, all my questions were answered by making notes, so good discussion.
Jim?
Well, I guess my concern is that the discussion about we've got a lot of vacant lands and that we don't need to worry about redevelopment. You've got to redevelop those before anybody will move in. It's amazing how much renovation has to take place before somebody will move into a vacant building. So I consider all those places redevelopable that are vacant.
Well, it's a big time experience.
I look for office space in downtown Springfield about 3 or 4 months ago, and I think there's an awful lot of vacant stuff now.
Is it stuff you take?
Yeah, it was
okay.
It was the right. I mean,
did you move it?
Yeah.
don't want to cast aspersions, but
no, no,
really,
no, it was.
It's difficult to find the right space and the right configuration.
I think, you know, some of the issues have to do with problems downtown. Some of the issues have to do with, you know, just there are vacant buildings. There always have been vacant buildings. And, you know, that's just what's happening in Springfield. So I think there is a potential to look at that 10% number and see that maybe go a little bit higher. I appreciate the presentation. I want to check in with people here and see if I could, do we, when you send out emails, do we have all the people's email addresses attached?
Yes. Or,
okay. Are people interested in the stuff that the Farm Bureau is doing? Enough that I could just send out an email and give you folks an update on that?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, so with your permission, I'll do that. I do think that that is an important thing for this group to look at, because as John said, you know, a lot of things that we just can't visualize are bound to happen, and this is one way to kind of conceptualize an alternative for a place in Springfield that's really the heart of Springfield that will be redeveloped at some point. And I think it would be valuable for the community. Thanks.
Well, I agree with you. There's a lot, you know, downtown Springfield old. There's some problems down there. But I see in the future it being redeveloped, because you have to have a nice looking community and buildings for people to move in. And Eugene's no different than us, because they got a lot of vacancy too.
Sure.
And I agree with George about the floodplains. When we move the EGV out, we shouldn't count the floodplains. We need to put more acreage, add more acreage to whatever floodplain is out there, so we have the right amount of land. But I've lived around here long enough, I know what the Christmas plate flood was, so no hospital would probably be a little wet. But yeah, I think we're going along in the right direction.
Question or request, I guess, for you, Dave. Is it possible to get these maps available like a digital format, so we can zoom in on this?
Sure. Actually, they should have been included in the PDF format.
Yeah, you
okay.
Can blow them up.
Yeah,
I didn't.
Yeah. That's not
bad. I guess I'm just kind of curious, Bob, if you have maybe an observation about, you know, as you mentioned in the EOA, you talk about the labor market, and obviously, you know, the number percentage of people in Springfield that commute to Eugene, and vice versa, how, you know, a lot of the workforce, a third of the workforce, lives within the city. Eugene's going to be on their own trajectory to do a similar kind of analysis. Do we need to be accounting for not only Springfield's employment growth needs, but some amount of Eugene's too, depending upon how their policies come out or their study or whatever?
I'm not going to answer that question.
What I will say is,
maybe 10 years before you get down.
Yeah, we are the consultant for the city of Eugene. That process is about to start. Their first citizen advisory committee meeting is
in
a few weeks.
I guess we couldn't do that and still be
what I will say about the way Eugene structured their work program is there are no policy decisions embedded in. No policy decisions are intended to come out of it. Now, that's sort of a loaded approach to this, because all of the things that we talked about today end up being policy decisions. What's constrained? What's not constrained? How much redevelopment are you going to get? And so on. So essentially, we're going through the same process with Eugene. And I think it's a legitimate question to ask. I just have no idea what the answer is going to be.
Are they using the same employment percentage, or is that the same safe harbor?
We haven't gotten to that.
Are you facilitating that as well over there?
They have.
Yes.
Yeah, so Eugene and Springfield submitted, both submitted post-acknowledgement plan amendments for the safe harbor population.
That's not a point.
Together or separately? Together. What motivated that? I mean, not doing it together, but what motivated a post-acknowledgement plan amendment to use the safe harbor as opposed to the municipal court?
Well, you know, I listened to this discussion earlier, and I think, you know, one of the things that I would encourage the committee to consider is, you know, what's the end game here? Is the end game to accomplish something as opposed to get yourself into a protracted appeal? And the reality of this thing is there's a high likelihood that it's going to be appealed to Woodburn. You can see what Woodburn is going through right now. Thin film went through right now. Almost any UGB expansion of any size at all is going to have an appeal. So the name of the game seems to be to not try to step over a dollar and become a nickel. And while you could say that, you know, I agree completely with what Danny even said earlier, that, you know, shouldn't we have a figure in there that's more realistic, that really reflects what good responsible planning would be? That's certainly an appealing, logical conclusion, but it's not necessarily the one that's going to get the results that I believe that the City Council and the Planning Commission are going to try to accomplish, and that is to get a separate boundary established and then to expand that boundary if the justification is there, as it appears to be, without quibbling about a few extra acres here, a few extra acres there. This is a 20-year plan. There's nothing that says, for example, that, as Lee said, she can't start an amendment process almost immediately after finishing the first one. So that's ultimately a decision for the City Council to sort out. How aggressive do we want to try to be? But I don't think anybody likes putting money into legal defenses and appeals. Is that
Yeah, it's a real sad commentary on Oregon's land use plan. It's just completely aggressive.
It took from 1976 to 1983 to do the first metro plan in the area. The first acknowledgement was done in 1987, and it took 2 years to do that. Maybe it's a little less than that. The next one took, did we ever finish it?
12 years.
The next one took 12 years. And I think that's been one of the problems why I think there's a quote big little task force, is because the concept was really good. The process of going through it has broken down since. I think this is, I think you guys have done a really good job putting this together. You know, there are things I would quibble about, but basically I pretty much like it. I will say that I disagree with Dan about Jack Roberts' comments. I think Jack raises some really good points. They're points that when I was running the Metro Partnership in the 15 years that I worked in that business in this area, it was always a problem. It was less of a problem in the 80s when the land use system worked really well because we had great predictability, we had sites, and we ran out of it, which I thought was always one of the strong points of Oregon's land use system, was you decided where you weren't going to develop it, but the other side of that is where you could develop. And we sort of ran out into a situation where as long as you couldn't develop anywhere. And I think that's where it broke down. We got to get back to doing that. The one thing that I'm a little concerned with is the structure doesn't seem to lend itself really well to aspirational goals, which, as I know, in the discussions the Planning Commission had with the Council, sort of getting to that, you know, I think Springfield, the elected leaders are kind of aggressive, would like to have that opportunity if that solar plant came in or that Target warehouse to have a place where they could have a choice to operate. I don't think we have that now. And I'm a little concerned about that. I would go back to the original Metro Plan in 1978, and this was all three of the general purpose governments in the area decided that they wanted to change the opportunities for people in the area to have some high-tech employment. It may have made some errors, but essentially they came up with six campus industrial sites that they designated, and debates and errors and put some of them in wetlands because they didn't know what a wetland was then, but basically that concept worked pretty well, and they're pretty much all developed now. So I'm not sure how we deal with that, Bob, but I think as we go forward, I think there is a need to have some larger sites. The problem with that I experienced was you designated a large site and it's really hard to convince a property owner not to split it up into 5-acre sites. I don't have a solution for that, but that's an issue that's out there. So.
Well, I think some of that can be dealt with in the next round of this. And again, we haven't articulated the site needs or
okay. And with that, we're 5 minutes over. Thank you all. It's good discussion tonight.
Our next meeting?
Our next meeting is, again, fourth Thursday, so that's October 23rd. And once again, we have a joint planned city council meeting on October 27th. If you're interested.
What time?
I believe it's at 6 p.m.
Where at?
That's here at City Hall. Usually the work sessions, it'll either be in this room or right across the hall over here in the Jesse main room. Just keep checking the city's website and you can verify at the time or give me a call or issue me a
David, is there a chance you can, particularly the points of agreement we added up, you can next week or two get those out to all the members, especially those who are here tonight, so they can come back from what we decided and we'll learn that.
Oh, yeah, the key points.
Yeah.
So you'll. Those maps at 0.5
second-hand
maps you out. How will you
get those 7?
How would, if you're willing to wait a little while, what I would propose is that we go through the process and post those out in the next couple of weeks.
We all better.
Rather than taking the one that we already saw.
That's another
time. So, if I just kind of
thresholds.
That's good. That's good.
You have to work with those numbers to see what kind of
community. Well, not nothing.